The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Sean.
Hi, my name is Sean and I am a very grateful alcoholic. Hi. I am actually very, very grateful to be here today because my sobriety date is September 10th, 2013. So, it is very amazing and humbling to be able to speak in front of this lovely group on my actual sobriety birthday. If you would have asked me 6 years ago to stand up in front of, I think there's like a billion of you out there, I would have been, no, oh, God, no, I can't do this. But 6 years down the road, I've learned to do it. You know, if a genie was standing in front of me and it said, I'm going to give you 3 wishes. You can A, speak in front of the Atlantic Group, or B, you can have like $1 million or something. You just have to stick your hand in a blender. I would have been like, is it a Cuisinart or a magic bullet? And how many knuckles deep do I really need to go in the bullet? Because I really just thought of myself and my own needs when approaching this. So again, I'm really glad to be here. One of the reasons that, you know, caused a lot of the anxiety I had was I felt threatened when I first came in here. I was really intimidated by all of you. What my story, what my mind, that voice in my head that, you know, I've been battling since I was a kid was saying to me was, you know, I'm not rich enough. I'm not skinny enough. I'm not good looking enough. I'm not whatever to qualify finding recovery in this room. You know, I'm just not enough. But again, you know, 6 years down the road, I can actually, if no one's ever said this before, it's a little nerve-wracking to stand up here. That might be something new that you've never heard, but I'll just tell you it's a little nerve-wracking to stand up here. But now, like, with confidence, because I have the program behind me, I can do this. So despite myself and, you know, what I've been doing in the program, I'm able to hopefully bring the message to you. It's not about my anxiety. It's not about my fears. It's not about my perceived shortcomings. What this is about, and the reason that I'm standing here today, is because if there's one person in all of you that relates to and can identify with what I'm saying and thinks about not picking up another drink, then all the work that I've been doing over the past 6 years, I'm able to give back, and I'm doing my job. Okay? So, when I first came to AG, again, I was really intimidated, but one of the things that happened was these two nice gentlemen, Jeffrey and James, sat me down, and they didn't ask me about my financial statement or my credit account. They just asked me how many days I had, and they welcomed me. And when you're in a room this big, it really is important to be welcome. So again, I just need to remember what my primary purpose is, what my purpose is to be here. So, how did this happen? How did a nice guy like me end up raving drunk? And in AA. So, you know, when I talk about my past and my upbringing, what I've learned from other qualifications is that the aspects of my past and my life didn't make me an alcoholic. They just made me me. And like, if you think of it this way, a planet becomes round when its mass, the gravitational pull on its mass pulls it to the center and it becomes round. Outside forces affected the way that it was shaped, the way that it turned out. So these outside forces created my reality, and created the way that I shaped and turned out, but again, it didn't have anything to do with me being an alcoholic. But to go back, one of the forces that shaped me was where I was from. I grew up in a suburban area in Colorado, a rural area, and my family was the only family that looked like me in the whole county. I was very isolated, and you know, when I was a kid, I just thought I was like everybody else, but then I was told just because of the amount of melanin that I had in my skin that I was different, And the issue was that I believed that. So I always felt like an outsider. I always felt like there was something about me that didn't fit in. And I always felt like people were looking at me. So I was very, very uncomfortable in my own skin. So we were welcome. I mean, we didn't have anything really hostile happen to us. But my parents were very protective, and I was very isolated. And just as, you know, as I developed, isolation became a way of safety and comfort for me. I was like a tourist in my own hometown, and I saw what others saw. I did what others did, but there was just something about me that wasn't the same. I was irritable, restless, and discontent. I suffered from undiagnosed ADD. I had depression, all of these things. I needed a solution. As a kid, I figured that I needed a solution. I needed a fix. And candy and books were how I took care of that. That was the first time I sought an outside substance to make myself feel better. I would traverse miles through scrub oak and ponderosa pine trees just to get a fix, a big bag of Jolly Ranchers, and when I got home, I would just throw them out on the floor and just binge into them because it made me feel better. Something from the outside I could put into me, and it made me feel better. When I read, my world morphed into the world of the characters that I was reading. It became something else, something other than reality. Move forward ahead into high school, where I had my first alcohol drunk. My white light moment came when I was drinking. All the anxiety, all the fear, all of the insecurity lifted away. I was happy. And I was an equal. Anyone that had a drink in their hand was my friend. The world was not a scary place. People were wonderful. I loved people. I loved to go and just, you know, wherever there was a party, wherever there was alcohol, I was happy. You know, when I went to school, when I went to college, my first go, I was like this post-punk kid with a fishbone haircut, if you don't know what that is. I just looked a little different from the hippies and the deadheads that were in my mountain town. But again, like, alcohol was that great equalizer. Alcohol was what gave me the freedom to, you know, meet other people and thrive in my mind with my solution, with what I needed. So I worked very, very hard to get what I needed to get ahead. And what I needed to get ahead was a drink. I moved anything that posed an obstacle to getting what I needed out of the way. Unfortunately, those things became studying and being there for people and friends. What I learned was that the problem wasn't within me, the problem was with all of you and the rest of the world. And, you know, that wasn't it. So I learned that if you moved away, if you left, that was the solution. I learned that if you looked out for number one and everything that you needed, that was a solution. What resulted from what I learned was when my mother was bedridden after surgery for a month, I wasn't there to help her. When my father died, when my father was dying and soon after died, I was not there for the family because when I finally came back home, I went to the bar. And when I was with the family, I was hammered and I didn't want to have anything to do with them. They were my problem. My father was dying and they were the problem. Why couldn't anyone think about me? So, after moving, after suffering consequences, after giving my life to alcohol and devoting all of my energy, time, and effort into being its slave, basically, what I learned when I was finally broken down, when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, was to give up, to admit to myself that the solution that I had created was not the truth. My truth was not the truth. And there's a wonderful book with 12 steps in it that can tell you how to redefine what your reality and what your truth is. The problem that I had with myself, the problem I had with spirituality, all of the answers and all of the keys are in this book. This book is great when you understand what it means, but it takes meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings to comprehend what could be this seemingly simple text, but it's very complicated. So all I have to say is if you're new and you identified with anything that I had to say, please, please keep coming back. Meeting makers make it. It works if you work it. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Claire.
Hi, I'm Claire. I'm an alcoholic. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm doing this. I have been sober since July 8th, 2011, and my sponsor is Tatiana. Speak into the microphone. She told me to say that. My sponsor is Tatiana G, and I have a grand sponsor. And I love them all, and I'm very grateful to be a part of the family. I was just sitting there going through all the things I was going to try to remember to say, and I was thinking, first of all, to remember my sobriety date. So I just had 8 years in July, and I was thinking about the last time that I drank, and I was actually... I just moved back to New York 4 years ago, and I was living in New York at the time, and I just was thinking, so I had a drink on July 7th, and I had a perspective change that night, which I was thinking about today, like a lot of this is perspective change, like that's our miracle that happens, right? And I was there with my friend, like my friend who I was always like, oh, I can't hang out with her anymore. Like, she's the bad one. Like, when we're together, we, you know, take an entire bottle of, like, three entire bottles of different medicines along with what we drink, which is what we mostly do. And so I can't hang out with her anymore. And I've known her since I was very little. And so I went and met up with her, and I, like, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't want to meet up with Liz. Like, what should I do? And so I went and met up with her, and we were at... he's laughing at me. We were at a bar, and at this point, I was kind of, you know, towards the end of my drinking, obviously, because that's when I got sober, and I had just tried everything, you know, and I had drank in every kind of way, and I was so exhausted and just couldn't figure it out, and I'd kind of succumbed to it at that point. Like, I just was drinking every day, and... Liz was like the only person, like I didn't admit I was an alcoholic. I never thought about it. And Liz was the only person that like we'd kind of have conversations about it. And she kept going to the bathroom. And she would go to the bathroom and her friend was there with us. And we were like having a conversation about drinking, of course, because that's what we would do. Like, and he was like, yeah, you know, like at a certain age, I started just drinking on the weekends. And like, you know, you have to like, stop drinking on the week, like, whoa, like, I'm get it together. And I just sat there. It was, like, very calm and still. And I was like, I can't do that. Like, in my head, I was like, I can't not drink. Like, I can't just drink on the weekends. And then I, like, was looking at Liz going in and out of the bathroom, and I was like, we're the same. Like, I'm the same as her. Like, we just, like, I have a problem. And then I went home, and it was like this beautiful, calm, clear night, and I was walking, and everything was just like really slowed down. Anyways, I woke up in the morning, and I went to work, and so what I was thinking is my work was on 61st and Madison, and I just was thinking, like, I all of a sudden had that moment. I was like putting on my uniform, because I had to wear a uniform, and... I just started crying. It just, like, this voice, you know, that, like, wasn't mine, it was, like, I'm an alcoholic, and just, like, said it, and I just started, like, bawling, and I, like, went into the office, and I was, like, somewhat friends with the assistant manager was there, and I was, like, I have to leave. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, to me, it was, like, such a big deal. And she's like, okay. I didn't know. Like, you know, it's, like, 9 a.m. Like, but to me, it was like, oh, my God. Like, it happened. Like, I know. And so, whatever, that happened. And then she probably wasn't surprised. But I went and I was crying, and because it was beautiful. It was like, you know, it's an amazing moment when this happens. And I was walking across Central Park and I was thinking, oh, I probably walked past here. And I walked through Central Park and I called my mom, who had tried to put me in rehab like a few years before, and I had broken out of rehab, and because Coke was my problem, I had quit Coke, and I was really not in a good place. That was probably like 3 years before this. And so anyways, I called her and was like, I want to go to rehab, like, because she had tried to get me to go. So I thought, you know, can I still go? So that's what happened, what it was like. When I speak, I often get stuck on what it was like. And I'll get stuck at like age 5. Like, I'll just get like before I even start drinking, like, but I did, just really quickly, I did drink alcohol, and I am an alcoholic. So I started drinking when I was around 11. I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and it's very normal there. It is truly very normal there to do drugs. I mean, you know, I think we're all like, oh, everyone did drugs. No, but like most people did drugs at a young age in Boulder. And most people didn't do well in my generation from that. So we did a lot of drugs and we did a lot of drinking. And probably from like age like 11 to 14, I drank really heavily and I was drinking alcoholically instantly, like blacking out and doing really scary things, having no idea what I was doing. And I just like went from 0 to 100. Like, I hadn't even had like tried alcohol yet, and I wanted to drink as much as I could. And I've thought about like when I was 13, I was at like my babysitter's house and my mom was driving me crazy and I didn't want her to come pick me up, and I was just like so frustrated, and I was in my babysitter's pantry like sneaking Baileys, like at 13. And it's like 15 years later, like, I was still denying to myself that I was an alcoholic. But I pretty much, like, for 15 years went through, like, drinking really hard and partying, and it was, like, a phase, and then I'd do something else, and then I'd go back into it, and I'd do something else. And whenever I would come out of drinking, I would, like, I struggled with other things, and I only mention it just to show that, like, I never got out of the isms. So when I would try drinking, like, my dry drunk then was, like, anorexia that took me to the hospitals and to the institutions, and, like, obsession with careers, which, like, were really great for some things, but it was always, like, almost death and destruction, and it was really exhausting. So it did progress. My disease progressed, and like I used to when I would go through like the drinking, the really bad drinking or the anorexia or whatever was happening, I would be like, I'd come out of it, like someone would like save me from it, and I'd be like, oh good, like that wasn't me, I don't know what happened, like, oh, I'm back to me. And then slowly it was like the good me wasn't the me anymore. Like, I slowly, my resilience went down, and I kept not getting back to like the better me. And drinking had like a bigger grasp on me, and it became more present and more apparent to the point where I like couldn't not drink a day. And I was sitting in Queens, like, you know, comparing myself to my friend. And so that's what it was like. I mean, I'm sure you can just kind of take my word for it that I was like, really, I drank in every single way. You know, I tried it all. I was like every single kind of drinking, every single like look, every style, whatever. Like, I did it all. And so by the end, there was no excuse I could come up with. Like, it was like, no, like, it wasn't like, oh, well, maybe I just needed to do it like this. Like, I did that. I did the 2 glasses of wine. I did the partying. I did the kegs. I did all of it. I liked it. I didn't like it. And I all still kept drinking. So I got sober, and that was 8 years ago. And so my alcoholism and my drinking, I explained to you, and then my alcoholism sober has been really intense for me. And it's been, like, I have gone through a lot of, like, in and out of sponsors, and I really believed in this program and, like, love it and understand it, and I never dropped into it and did the steps. And about, like, a year ago, it just, like, I kept trying to, like, oh, get a sponsor and do it, or, like, I just kept, like, living by my will and thinking that I was doing the program because I would think about it or it was in my head, and I was really miserable, and I kind of tried being sober in every single way. And by the time I was about 7 years, I, like, didn't want to go speak on my anniversary because I was like, I haven't done the steps. Like, I haven't done the steps, and I just started to be kind of ashamed, and I knew that I had one other option. And I went away. I just had gone through dry drunk and depression, and then it got a little bit better, but it still just kind of kept going, like, mainly down. And then and then I just prayed about it, and I went to a meeting, like, 6 months ago, and a woman, I just was like, please show me someone that I can hear. Like, just, and I heard a friend speak, and she talked about being around the same time, and I, like, heard them. I heard her, and then I heard some other people from that sober family, and that's whom I'm a part of their sober family now, and I'm working the steps as the program is defined in the big book, and my life is changing. So thank you very much for having me.
And our main speaker tonight is Jim.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Jim, I'm an alcoholic. I love this group. I mean, they actually set the microphone for you and everything. It's great. I'm a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. Is anybody here a satisfied customer of AA? Come on, let's hear it. Come on. Much better. You should all be joyous about the fact that you are sober in AA. None of us should actually be sitting here enjoying life, and yet here we are. My home group is the Into Action Group of New York. It's a big book step study that meets on 96th Street at St. Francis de Sales Church at 6:30 on Wednesday night. We'd love you all to come, just not all at once. We go through the big book, go through the steps using our big book, and half the room usually has over 20 years of sobriety. It's set up like it's your living room, and you're talking to old-timers about going through the steps. It's nothing better. It's been my home group since I actually left this group 22 years ago to help found it. And I'm so pleased to see that the Atlantic Group is drawing so many people and carrying your great message. And I want to thank the group for asking me to speak here this evening. It's really an honor to speak at any AA group. The last convention I spoke at was at the North Sea Convention in Oostend, Belgium, and it was smaller than this. It's always a pleasure to be able to carry this wonderful message. You know, I look around, and every one of the people in this room is a miracle. And yet, we don't talk about it that way because we see it so often. But there is no less a miracle than the alcoholic who doesn't drink, or the blind seeing, or the lame walking. And you should look at sobriety just that way, because I certainly do. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on August 8th of 1980, at the ripe old age of 17, and I've never gone back out. I was in the right place. At that very moment, I had this moment of grace that every alcoholic gets when they walk through the rooms, into the rooms of AA. And it's up to us to do something about that moment of grace that we get. Now, I didn't know what the hell grace meant, so I had to look it up in a dictionary, and it's an unearned gift. Each of us gets this unearned gift. It's up to us to do something about that unearned gift. And we come to AA, and hopefully we get sponsorship that helps us to grow spiritually. If anybody's offended by me saying the word God, you better get up right now, because I'm going to say it all night long, at least until 10 o'clock. So I grew up in northern Westchester after being born here in Manhattan. My mother was an alcoholic, and there was plenty of drama with my mother. My dad was this icy intellectual economist who worked for IBM. It's like, you know, Star Trek, James Kirk married Mr. Spock. That's exactly what it was like. I don't know how the hell those two guys got together. They had really nothing in common other than my mother was single with a young daughter, and my father was divorced and looking for a wife. Put them together, three kids later, she comes into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1971. They split apart. We moved from this beautiful home on 5 acres in northern Westchester into an apartment complex. And from my earliest recollections, I felt like I didn't fit in. Like I was this round peg in a square hole. And I see there's a couple of people nodding their heads because they felt the same way. And the funny thing is, when I picked up my first drink, that went away. It went away. I felt like I was part of the human race, finally. Now, my first drinking took place when I was, you know, a teenager, 14, 15, 16. But the first time I really got drunk was at my mother's wedding in 1974. So my mother was going to AA meetings, and there was a series of babysitters. They babysat myself and my younger siblings. And I got seated at the table with all these teenage girls. Of course, I'm 12 years old. I'm loving every minute of it. And they decide to feed me Tom Collins's. And I'm drinking Tom Collins's like their soda. I get drunk. I dance. I have a great time. I request songs from the DJ. It was fantastic. Fantastic. I go to my dad's house, I pee the couch, and I couldn't wait to do it all over again. That was my first real drunk, and it made me feel better than I ever felt before, and I was going to chase that with each successive drink I took. And as time passed on, the repercussions of my drinking would start to happen. So fast forward, I'm in high school. I wised up to the fact that if you were out sick, you had to write a note, and that was the means by which you were excused for being out sick. So my sister was a freshman, and I was a junior, and they sent home at the beginning of the year an emergency card. So guess who signed the emergency card? That was me. I signed the emergency card. So, and then I would cut school, write my own notes, and they would be comparing my signature against my signature. It was great. I cut out of most of my 11th and 12th grade. I hung out on the side of the school building and partied it up. By this time, I'm drinking 3 or 4 nights a week. I had this tendency to make good money, so I was able to afford the drinking I did. Started driving and drinking at the same time. I had my first car was a 1974 Pinto wagon. And I put 60,000 miles on that car in the first year, and I never left Westchester County. And mainly because there was a cooler full of beer, and my buddies, and all we do is drive around and drink. You know, that was my reason for existence. I was smart enough that I could get away without studying too much. And after that junior year, my mother said, well, let's buy you a nicer car. So it was a 1977 Pontiac Firebird. Beautiful. So this is 1979. So this is the nicest car in a parking lot. And, of course, you know, I'm drinking every day by now. I only had to take 3 classes to graduate, so guess how many classes I took? 3, right? Well, I'm not going to extend myself. So 3 classes, and they ran from 10 to 12. And then I went to my job from 1 to 9 at a nursing home where I made, it was like 10 bucks an hour. Back then, that was good money for a kid. And after work, we would go up to the Dial Tone Lounge up in Danbury, Connecticut. The phones had been ripped out years ago, but I was there for nickel beer night. And I wasn't a connoisseur of fine wines and beers. That just wasn't how I drank. There was no pinky up or anything like that. I drank for effect. Anybody here drank for effect? I can't hear you. Yes, you did. Come on now. We're alcoholics. This is what we do, right? So here I am, drinking and driving now 6 or 7 days a week, and I almost didn't graduate high school. Now, alcoholics are masters at covering their tracks. And I was one of those guys. I managed to weasel out of just about everything that came down the line. Now I had to pass the Regents' final exam with an 80 or better in order to graduate. So I pulled myself together, studied the whole course in 3 days, and I got a 91. I ended up graduating high school in 1980 from Yorktown Heights. And I picked the school that I was going to go to, not on the academic offerings, but the Bridge Street Run. If anybody's familiar with Oswego, New York, there's a street that runs from east to west. The campus is on the west end of town. I was going to drink my way back to campus every single day. That was my plan. It wasn't because I was going to study this or that, but God had other plans. So I graduate. I'm drinking every day by now. My mother's starting to get, you know, wise to my act. You know, I would go to anniversaries every year that she'd celebrate. Back then, there was smoking in the room. So it would be a room this big. You couldn't see the back of the room at all. It was just haze that hung over everything. My eyes would tear. But everybody was so grateful. But I never connected that there was a possibility I might be one of you. So the first week of August of 1980, my mom and my stepfather went to Long Island on vacation. My brother and sister were at camp. I threw parties all week long in that apartment. And the night before they came home, before CSI was a thing, I cleaned that place like it had never been cleaned before. There was no evidence that anything went on in there. None at all. They come home. I go up to Maya Pack to a pool party. Now, mind you, the party's starting at 7. I get there at 5 so that I can make sure the keg's running smooth. Not my party, but I'm there. First things first, all. And I didn't get away from that keg except to make room for more beer. Around midnight, I had to go home to Yorktown. My mother had been saying, hey, you got to get home at a reasonable hour. I start on my way. I go on to Gomer Street in Somers just as I'm going into Yorktown, and I pass out of the wheel at that beautiful car and hit a telephone pole doing 50 miles an hour. And like any good drunk, I didn't have my seatbelt on, smashed the windshield with my head, but I was able to walk away from it. And that was the moment of truth that happened. I connected my trouble with my drinking, where I wasn't able to do that ever before. I wandered across the street to a house where the lights came on magically at 1 o'clock in the morning. And they told me I could use the phone. I called up my mom, and I said, I've been out drinking, I wrecked the car, maybe I'd go to AA. And the stream of obscenities that came over the phone have not yet stopped. Not yet stopped. Go home to more of the same, and go to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. Wake up early in the afternoon. And my mind was telling me I was too young, I made a couple of mistakes, and be different next time. Anybody's mind tell them it was just a mistake, wasn't that bad? Yeah, a couple of you out there, right? The real alcoholics are shaking their heads. Exactly. That's exactly what I said to myself. And right then, my mother walked into the room with a list of names and numbers, and so she said, I am not going to be your AA taxi service, I'm not your concierge. You have to do this. You have to own your recovery if you're going to do this. She said, you better make a phone call if you want to get to a meeting. And I called one of those people on the list, family, friends, brought me to my very first meeting, Bedford Village. And it was an open meeting, and I walked in, and back then I had this Fu Manchu mustache and a white complexion and long, scraggly hair. I looked like I was part of the FALN, if anybody remembers that terrorist group. And magically, two guys grabbed me as soon as I walk into the door. You must be new. You must be new. And they taught me how to identify with speakers. They didn't just say, identify, don't compare. But they taught me how to identify with speakers. They told me it's very easy to exclude yourself from Alcoholics Anonymous. We're all a little bit different, but we're all very much the same. And I have to look for that common ground. Now, I didn't drink in bars all the time and all that, but I did enjoy the wonderful fear and anger, resentment, and all the other fun things that went with drinking and being an alcoholic. Because drinking, after all, is only a symptom of our disease. If it was a not drinking club, we could all say, hey, I stopped drinking, and that's it. But our problem is not necessarily drinking, it is alcoholism. And there's a big difference, and those guys in my very first AA group told me that. I got sober with the cops and robbers up in Westchester, at the Crow Hill group, and they did not pat me on the head and say, come on, Jimmy, let's get sober. They did not say that. They treated me like any other alcoholic. They laid out the spiritual tools for my inspection. They did not allow me to share at any of the group meetings, except for beginners meetings in my 90 days. And they taught me how to get sober, not only by using the book, but showing me what it looked like. Because, let's face it, if all we're doing is stopping drinking and not changing, we're not practicing Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you that right now. We have to change the people we bring to AA, otherwise we're doomed to drink again. And they did not soft sell the idea of God from the very beginning. I was told early on, look at step 12, what does it say? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's the point of the exercise. You are going to have a relationship with a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So going to meetings morning, noon, and night is all fine and good, but you need to work the AA program and develop that relationship with a power greater than yourself. Now, God's crazy about me. I'm very much happy to say that. I am safe and protected no matter where I happen to go. I get to live these spiritual principles on an ongoing basis. And it's very important for me to do just that. My mother used to say, this is not a not drinking club, and I think she hit it right on the head. That being said, you know, I wish I could say, stand up here and say, everything went well, I made my first million when I was 18 years old, blah, 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 blah. That's not the case. Life goes on. You know, I went away to that school, 3 weeks into sobriety, and I stayed sober. I started a meeting on campus. I stayed in touch with my sponsor, and we started working through the steps. I did my fourth step when I was sober about 90 days. And the hardest thing I ever did was reveal my innermost self to another human being. And it's probably the hardest thing that any alcoholic is going to do, because we don't want people to see what's going on in there. Right? I didn't like myself. I sure as hell knew you weren't going to like me. And I sat down with that sponsor. My first sponsor was a guy called Jimmy the Hat. Still sober now. He's never worn a hat in his life. But they call him Jimmy the Hat. Worked on the railroad. He got sober at 22. What I didn't know until a couple of years ago was I was his very first sponsee. And I get choked up from time to time. You have to excuse me. So he carried this message to me, went through the steps with me, got helped me to look, get through this book and understand the directions, and I started to see things differently. When I moved to Long Island, I met a guy named Don M. He's still sober today. He brought me to this 12-step shade, and he was the one who said, read step 12 out loud. Read it slowly. And at the end of it, he says, you need to become God conscious. You need to have this in your life at all times. Now, we're very fortunate. The big book is full of wisdom. And what most people don't realize is that from the bottom paragraph of page 85 to the end of page 88, right, the end of chapter 6, are the daily instructions for spiritual living. It tells you what to do when you go to bed at night. It tells you what to do throughout the day. And it tells you what to do in the morning. It's simple. Now, I was scared of this meditation thing. Ooh. I thought I had to sit on top of a mountain, assume the lotus position, and go, Om. I had no desire to do any of that. But, you know, the book doesn't even tell us that. So our roots come from a very Christian philosophy. And years ago, in the Christian church, there was contemplative meditation. And that's exactly what is laid out in the book. And it's a great place to start. There's quite a few people here who have been to the 11-step meditation meeting that I and others run at in Hampton Bays, in East Quag and Bridgehampton, and we read that part of the book each time. And the beautiful thing is people are flocking to those meetings because it's so approachable. It doesn't have to be this esoteric thing that people can't get their minds around. It's really important that we make this program approachable to people, which means we don't soft sell God, but we talk about how it's laid out in masterly detail in our book. So the most important fact of my life today is this relationship with God. And I have a fantastic life today, even though it continues to be unmanageable. How could it be unmanageable if it's fantastic? Well, I got a manager in step three. And if I let him do the work, my life turns out great. It takes me places I wouldn't possibly have thought I could possibly go. But I have to turn my life utterly over to him. The words in the big book are strong for a reason. Because this is what's going to save our ass, is this relationship with God. So I moved out of the city 16 years ago. My wife and I moved out. We live up in Bronxville, New York. And I commute into the city every day. I manage an office building down in Soho. But each morning starts with prayer meditation. And I don't have a black belt in meditation like one of my friends does. She's shaking her head over there. But it's even if it's just 10 or 15 minutes, reading through that part of the big book, I also read Around the Year with Emmett Fox, and I get started off on the right foot. You know, how am I bringing the vision of God's will into my life? You know, I work in New York real estate. Anybody who works in New York real estate knows it can be, you know, the elbows out and everything else. But I bring these principles into my office, and people want to do business with me. They get a fair shake. They know exactly what they're going to give me. The tenants enjoy the fact that I wake up in the morning, do this stuff, go to my office, I run a big book step study online, and have for the last 20 years. It's an email that goes out every morning. And by the time the phone rings, I'm not saying, oh, crap, what do they want? I'm saying, how can I be of service? Let me solve your problem. Let me solve your problem, and I take care of whatever it happens to be. You know, God is my partner in everything that I do. But like I said this past Sunday on the beach, there can only be one Jim Kelly. Right? The guy you find in an AA room is hopefully the guy you find on the road, the guy you are doing business with, part of your family, which means I bite my tongue quite a bit. There are many things I don't need to get involved with, no matter how much I think they might benefit from my experience. Anybody get beat up because of that? Emmett Fox talks about it like grabbing an unfamiliar dog by its ears. You know what happens? You're going to get bitten. That's exactly what he talks about. And I talk a lot about Emmett Fox. I, too, run retreats up at the Wilson House for the last 22 years or so. And we're going to be meeting in March. And this year, we're going to be meeting on the spirituality of imperfection and a second surrender in AA. It's something that comes out of Chuck Chamberlain's book. And why I bring that up is very important to me personally. My mother picked up a drink after 20 years of sobriety, died 3 years later, penniless at the age of 59. Right? I was sober 13 years. I was doing the deal, but, you know. At that time, I recommitted myself to Alcoholics Anonymous. Stopped dabbling in it like it's some kind of a hobby. You know, squeezing it in amongst life. Not that I go to meetings all the time, but the spiritual principles of AA are present throughout. And every alcoholic, at some time or another, is going to face this period in their life where it's just not working. And what am I going to do? Am I going to pick up a drink, shoot myself, or recommit myself to this wonderful fellowship and these spiritual principles? We see people suffer in AA all the time. It's up to us to provide that example and notice when that kind of thing happens and talk to these people so they don't feel isolated, so that they are part of this community. So carrying this message is very important to me. I get to carry it everywhere I go. I have opportunities to speak all over the world, speak before groups like this. I sponsor dozens of people around the country. I'm taking a guy in India through the steps using Messenger and email. You know, this is my life today. And there's no better satisfaction than seeing someone's eyes open up to this great way of life. It's a way of life, not a program. It's a way of life. And I have to keep that in mind. And what's the result? I have a great life today. I'm married to a wonderful woman who has heard me speak enough that she's not here tonight. I'm surrounded with wonderful friends. I have a fantastic career that I fell ass backwards into. I have friends wherever I go, no matter where I happen to go. You know, we're blessed, and we can't forget how blessed we are. So I was going to mention something that took place 18 years ago, tomorrow, and I was in my office in New York, sober 21 years. And it's because of these principles I was able to walk through my client losing hundreds of people, all the chaos that ensued, and be a power of example. You know, hopefully, I'm an example of God in action. So step 12, when they originally wrote step 12, it originally said, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Any one of us can walk on water in the rooms of AA, but get out there with the rest of the gang, and let's see how you do. So yesterday, I had an appointment with a dermatologist, so I leave work early to go. I'm sitting with the dermatologist, and I'm like, so what am I here for? She's like, I don't know. I have another appointment on Thursday, it turns out. I'm supposed to have this spot taken off of my hand. Now, my first reaction is to give her a lot of crap about wasting my time. Right? A couple of you guys would do the same thing, wouldn't you? But I said, okay, I'll come back Thursday. Just don't make me pay you the copay for this trip. But, you know, so what? I had an opportunity. Now, to cap it off, I ended up tripping on the street and gashing my knee and ruining my jacket, but it's all good. I can shake this stuff off today. My superpower is ignoring things. Ignoring things. The crap I get wrapped up in today, I avoid. It's not my fight. I don't have a horse in that race. I stay away from it. Right? I'd rather be a spectator to it than a participant. Let me tell you, having been beaten up more and more. So, you know, generally speaking, I avoid, you know, having my mouth open, my foot in it. I keep my mouth shut most of the time. But I make mistakes every day. And if anybody gets up here and says they don't make mistakes, please drag them out of the room. Please drag them out of the room. We make mistakes. It's part of what we do. What we need to do is not crucify ourselves for having made the mistakes, but to learn from them. Ask God to take us to better things. You know, and I've had to learn a lot of lessons in sobriety, and we all do. I want to thank this group for having me speak tonight. And thank you for listening.